short people problems. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. It sounds the exact same up here, so if you ever come up here, don't be afraid of the mic. It sounds the same. So my name's Ryan, and I'm an alcoholic. And I choose to identify myself as an alcoholic because I primarily attend Alcoholics Anonymous, but that does not mean by any definition that that's the only thing that I use to escape reality. So I want to be very clear with that because I've heard a lot of things about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's a cult, and there's all those naysayers out there that say, I've done other drugs, I'm not an alcoholic, whatever. My story is that I will use anything and everything under the sun, including but not limited to drugs, alcohol, reading, men, women, shopping, eating, and the list goes on. What's it say in the book? Ad infinitum. I didn't even know what that meant when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So not only have I gained sobriety, but I have gained an extensive vocabulary thanks to 1935 language. So my job is to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born to two alcoholics who met in the rooms of AA. So I am the product of 13th stepping before you should. I think I turned out all right. My mother stayed sober, and my biological father did not. At 18 months, she left him. I am sad to report that he still has not maintained sobriety. As a result of working the steps and outside help, I did meet him 2 years ago. And what's amazing about that is that I was able to apologize to him and make amends to him. Because my part in that resentment was that I beat up everyone around me, including the man I had never met, for not loving me. And I learned through the steps that even though I may not have had an active part in the abuse of my life, the fact that I continue to replay it and beat myself and everyone else around me is my part. And I have a choice in that. And so I grew up in a home that did not have alcohol in it. My dad was a normie, and if he had a beer, it was a beer. My mom was sober my whole life. The first time I remember my parents fighting was because my dad gave me NyQuil, because he did not understand the allergy. Neither did I, but I learned quickly. I was not allowed to have virgin margaritas because it was, you know, simulating the drinking. And it was a very clean household. I grew up Southern Baptist, so I knew a God. Thankfully, that is not the God I have today, but it served me. That'll come later. I went to public school, grew up lower middle class. I had everything I needed, but nothing that I wanted. I wanted love from anyone and everyone that give it to me, and I could never get it. I wanted, you know, the newest Abercrombie shirt and the Doc Martens. I didn't get those. I got the ones on the clearance rack that were last year's, and I got the Doc Martens that were not the cool ones to have. So I spent my entire childhood seeking all this outside stuff to change the way I felt, to make me feel a part of, because I knew that that one person that was supposed to love me didn't, so why would you? And I like to say that I was an Al-Anon long before I ever picked up a drink or a drug, because everything in my life had to be perfect. I had to have control of everything. When the brother didn't do what he needed to do, I made sure and put him in his place and tell him what he needed to do. When the kids in the class did not do what they needed to do, I made sure to put them in their place and tell them what they needed to do. I was a straight-A student, and I lost my cool in first grade when I had to go to the hospital and I messed up my perfect attendance. Like, I was the goody-two-shoes that did everything right. Because that was the way I knew to behave to get the love. That's how I knew I could maintain that picture-perfect lifestyle. You know, my dad would always say, oh, my kids are the ones, you know, that I would take out in public. My kids always impress me, and they always look the best and behave the best. And all that did was reinforce, oh, I have to be good. I have to make dad happy so he doesn't leave too. Like, I have to make sure and do everything just right so that everyone loves me. And then that didn't work because it only works for so long, right? Like, I spent my entire life pleasing everybody else, and then all of a sudden, it stopped working. Just like the drugs and the alcohol, that perfect person on the outside, it stopped working. And I was a teenager, and I experienced some sexual abuse. And that was, looking back, I can see it, but in the moment, I had no idea what was really happening. But what happened was the key turned. I no longer had control. In that moment, I lost all control. And so what do? Like a good alcoholic, I went from one side of it being perfect to the other side of raising holy terror. And I was no longer a straight-A student. I was no longer the perfect little girl. I did everything you told me not to do. I went from headed to, I could have had a scholarship to anywhere I wanted, probably. I mean, I'm not bragging in any form, but as a full-time student and employee at the age of 30, I have a 4.0. And that's because today I have no problem being the best I can be. I'm not here to sabotage my life anymore, and that's what I was capable of then, but would tell myself that I wasn't. I didn't deserve it. So I threw it all away. I started beating up everybody around me emotionally, physically, mentally, and sexually. And I became the person that I despised the most. I became my birth father. I became all those people that I couldn't make love me. And I pushed everyone in my life away. And I dropped out of high school, and I ran away from home. Meanwhile, at home, I had a little brother that was 5 years younger than me who was suffering from mental illness. He was one of us. And my parents were having to fight that and deal with that. And I had told myself, I'm the problem, so I'm just going to remove myself, and everything will be okay. Which, I mean, I was the problem. I was causing a lot of chaos. But again, it's that self-sabotaging mentality and behavior, right? And I started telling myself that my family didn't love me, and so why even be a part of it? And for the next years, from 16 until probably about 2021, I maybe talked to my family once a month, if that. My mom was the only one I really kept in contact, and that was because she found out through a friend where I was, and she would show up there every Wednesday with $20 and beg me to come home, and I would say no. She would give me $20, and then we would wait for the next Wednesday to come. And that was what my life looked like. I was not a part of my family's life. I wasn't there for the holidays, really. I wasn't there for anything. And then at 20, I met the boy. And I got my life together, and I stopped doing all the hard drugs, and I only drank wine, so I was sophisticated. I mean, the reality was, it was one of the big bottles of Behringer a night. Like, not the skinny one that had four glasses, the big one, every night. And he sold weed, so how perfect was that? I just set myself up to get everything I wanted right there, and I knew that the only way to get this guy to marry me was to behave. So I cleaned up my act, and I was like, I'm going to go to college now, and I'm going to get my life together and be that picture-perfect girl again. And it looked that way on the outside. It did. We had the house. We had the cars. I had the job. I was going to school. I wasn't out belligerent every night. But when I would hit that point, I would do the same thing to him that I'd done to everybody else, and we would fight, and I would push him away. And there was in 2 years that we lived together and were together, not once did we tell each other we loved each other. Because why? It doesn't really exist, does it? We're just, you know, friends that live together, smoke together, and do the other fun stuff together, right? And it just became this comfortable relationship. And the breaking point was... And to me, I look back and I laugh at this in life because my whole life was me saying one thing and doing another. Like whenever I did my inventory, my sponsor was like, do you see that? Like you say that you will never cheat on someone. But yet, how many of these relationships were you the other woman? You know, how many times were you the one getting cheated on? It takes two to tango. And she's like, but you would pride yourself and say, I'm not a cheater. Which I wasn't, but I was most definitely the other woman. Always. And I was always the one getting cheated on when I wasn't. And so I spent my whole life saying one thing and doing another. And in this relationship, this guy didn't believe in God. And I was like, oh, I can't be with someone that doesn't believe in God. How are we going to raise our kids? And that was the deal breaker for me. And now I look back and see that, like, I was totally settling because I kept telling myself, well, he doesn't beat me. He's a really nice guy. I should stay with him. And yes, he was a great guy. He was a sweetheart. But I was definitely settling in that relationship. So at 21, I moved out and I was like, I'm going to live my life. I'm going to see the world. I'm going to travel. I'm going to do all this amazing stuff. And I did. I traveled once to Miami. I don't remember any of it. I stayed in the hotel most of the day, nursing the hangover, and went out at night and saw the four walls of the same club every night because that was the one that I had met the bouncer to the first night I got there, so I got the hookup, you know? And I traveled to the same three bars, Janie's, Chuggin' Charlie's, and John's Place in Spring, Texas, if any of y'all are familiar. I went to the same bars every night, and I would end at Chuggin' Charlie's and wonder why I threw up when I ended the night with a Bloody Mary after drinking all night. The insanity. It literally took me months to figure out why I was throwing up every time I'd go out drinking. And, I mean, even on nights where I was like, let's just hang out and take it easy. We're going to have an easy night. I would still have the big bottle of wine, and I'd be smoking and sitting in my garage getting hammered. And I can't tell you how many nights I fell asleep in that garage on the couch with a cigarette in my hand, a bowl in the other hand, and my beer between my legs. And then I would wake up to really cold beer being spilled all over me, my cigarette burning my finger, and my bowl dumped over and spilled all over my chest. Like, how I did not burn my house down, I have no idea. Obviously, you know, a power greater than myself, because myself put myself in harm's way constantly. In that spurt of 21 to this next chapter, I wrecked my car 3 times in 2 weeks, was drinking on all of them, did not go to jail once, and just kept saying, God, I have terrible luck. What is happening here? I mean, one of those times, I was in the rental car because I had totaled my car, and my best friend, who had just left the bar, plowed into the back of me, left the rental car bumper in the middle of the road, and I'm like, we got to get out of here. We've been drinking. So we shoved the bumper of a Toyota Camry inside of a Toyota Prius and leave. Her car was the Toyota Prius, and when she took it to the body shop the next day, it was 1 inch away from being totaled. Like, it's just things like that that constantly happened in my drinking and using that I look back and I can't believe I'm still here. I also have to laugh at myself because I'm supposed to be living my best life because I'm single and, like, I can enjoy the world, and I wasn't doing that, but I was having a good time every night. And then came my worst nightmare. In my drinking and using up to this point, I had tried to kill myself twice. Which I'm sure many of you have that same experience. It happens. The drink and the drugs are no longer taking away the pain, and we can't do anything else but think to end it. And by some power greater than myself, I survived those 2 times. My brother did not. And in October of 2010, he killed himself in my parents' home. And I got the phone call that day, and it was the perfect storm. It was like, we had all had Tuesdays off normally. Well, that Tuesday we all had to work. And it was just so many different things. And I played those that day over and over and over in my head, thinking of what I could have done differently. Well, I could have not gone out the night before until 6 o'clock in the morning. So maybe I wouldn't have slept in. You know, maybe if I was as close to my family as I, you know, wanted to be, and I would have, like, checked in with my brother and known more about his life and this and that. And I just would beat myself up over and over and over again. But the reality is that some of us make it out and some of us don't. You know, that is the insidious reality of this disease is that some of you will not make it out of this life sober. And that was the catalyst for my sobriety. Because after my brother died, I knew nothing else but to numb it and make it go away. Right? Like, it's like, again, the insanity of my brother just killed himself while he was coming down off of his acid, because it was his 18th birthday the weekend before. Like, so he's coming down off of that. He hadn't taken any of his antidepressants for however many days because he was too busy partying. He got drunk the night before and woke up hungover and was like, I'm done. Who can blame him? Like, I couldn't blame him. I was like, yeah, I get it. I've been there. And so then, the only way I know to cope is to do the same exact thing. And for the next 6 months, I went to the same three bars every night and did the same thing I'd always done and ended at Janie's because it was right outside the neighborhood. And there I am sitting at the bar at 2 a.m. with Fred, who's 70 years old, trying to escape his wife. And I'm this cute little 22-year-old that everybody's looking at me out of the side of their eye going, is she next? And so what do? I moved to Austin because that's going to fix everything. Nobody knows me there. Nobody knows what happened. Nobody knows how much of a drunk I am. I'll go there. This town is terrible. The people in it, why would I want to stay here? Like, that's the problem. The problem is this town. If what Devin and I would have left and gone to Austin when I said we should have, he would have been alive. So that's where I'm going. So I went. The next morning, that night, I made the decision, sitting at the bar at Janie's, that I was going. The next morning, I woke up and I told my mom, and she's like, okay. And I drove up here during South By. What a great time to shop for a job. But I got a job. And I worked at Lavaca Street Bar. I came up here, I stayed on a friend's couch for 7 days, and I found a house. Side note, I had someone that, you know, had no problem handing me money to go find things. You know, of course, with the return of some favors, right? And so that's how I started my life in Austin. I had someone to give me a car, give me a house, do all of these nice things for me with certain little favors in return. And I came to Austin knowing two people. And I embarked on meeting new friends. And where's the best way to meet new friends? At the bar. But the trick was, now this is where things got sticky, is that I had to look like I was a lot of fun. But then I had to stop myself before I hit that point because they couldn't know how crazy I was. So then once I'd hit that point, I'm like, all right, it's time to go home. So then I'd go home and I'd have to make sure that I had enough in the fridge at home to get me to the level that I really needed to be at. And that was the cycle that I did. And so this is April of 2011. And my brother's 1 year anniversary is October of 2011. And it really gets nasty at that point in time. And the next 2.5 months are a complete total blur. I don't remember that holiday. I don't remember anything about the next few months. And I've pretty much isolated myself from everyone. And in January of 2012, I get suspended from my job because some girl can't handle her liquor. And I get in trouble for it because she says I drugged her. I'm like, no, she probably just shouldn't have smoked as much when she drank that much. If she could hang with me, then we'd all be okay. But my bosses didn't see it that way, so I got suspended. And in that period, I went home to Houston to work at a bar for a while to make some money, and I came back, and my 24th birthday party, I had this big old party bus, and all these people were coming, and we were going to go to the strip club, we were going to go to this bar, because I knew this manager, and we were going to get VIP here, and don't you see how cool I am, and all of y'all are going to come and have fun with me. And then nobody wanted to really come, because who would want to hang out with me? And so then the rest of the night, I just beat the living snot out of everyone around me because nobody loved me enough to come to my birthday party. That was the last night I drank. And that was a Saturday night. I had a Shiner Light Blonde watching the Texans lose in the playoffs that year on Sunday. And I dried up Monday and Tuesday, and I went to my first meeting at Westlake 8 o'clock on Wednesday night. And I sat in the back corner and I cried and I cried and I cried and I cried forever. And then I went to a meeting the next day and I cried and I cried and I cried and I cried forever. And the only thing I remember from that first 30 days of sobriety, well, first 30 days of not drinking, I should say, is that a guy that was in my trig class was at the same meeting. And I was so confused as to why a guy was in the same place. And then the guy at the bar that I would go eat at between class and the meeting, because that was real smart, he was also in the program and said that he had decided to be abstinent for 90 days. And I was like, well, isn't that a concept? So I thought about it and I prayed about it and I was like, oh, I might try that out. Meanwhile, I was still smoking every day because alcohol was my problem, obviously, not weed. Like, I didn't beat people up when I was high. I only beat them up when I was drunk, so I don't need to quit smoking. Well, I asked someone to be my sponsor, and because this is a program of rigorous honesty, I told her I was smoking, but it's okay because it's not a problem. And she was like, yeah, I don't think that's how this really works. And she's like, you know that hole that's in your soul, that, you know, that loneliness and that despair that you feel every day when you wake up? She's like, that hole doesn't get filled when you walk around in a fog all day. She's like, what you're seeking is connection. What you're seeking is a love that you can't feel when you're not present. And the only way to be present is to be completely sober. And I was like, oh, here we go. Fine. And me being the stubborn little toot that I am, and this relationship with God that I have, I was like, if you want this life for me, then remove the obsession. That's what they keep talking about. They say, oh, well, the obsession was removed. So if that's the kind of life you want for me, if you want me to even stop smoking, which I don't understand why, then remove the obsession. And I won't do it. So I loaded a bowl, and I put the bowl on my kitchen counter, and I was like, do it, and I'll stay sober for you. I went 4 days and didn't smoke. That had never happened in my life. I was like, okay, fine. I guess I'll try this thing. So I told my sponsor, I'll give you a year. If I don't have this spiritual experience that you talk about within a year, then I'm going to smoke again. I know I'm not going to drink because I'm crazy, but I'm going to smoke again. She said, fine. I'll take a year. And I embarked on the 12 steps of recovery. It took me 6 months to get through my 4-step. I do not recommend that at all. That was terrible. Like, I thought I was an emotional basket case when I was drinking and using. Sitting on your 4-step for 6 months and walking around being pissed off at everybody because of that guy at the stop sign. And like, I mean, I had to be thorough because I'm the perfectionist, right? Like, I follow directions. I went back to that. And so I was thorough. And I wrote down every single person that gave me every look at the stoplight and in the grocery store. And I'm going to put it all down. And the only thing I really got out of all of that is like how really selfish and self-centered I am. And my first sponsor told me that selfish is you think this, you're the center of the world. Self-centered is you think that everybody else thinks that you're the center of the world. And I was like, oh, got it. And my first round of the steps, I did the best that I could. I just got it down, like, got it out. And I switched sponsors in the middle of my amends, which is another thing I don't recommend. I've done a lot of things that I don't recommend, and somehow I've stayed sober. And in that sponsorship, I learned relationship. I learned how to be a friend, because for the first 18 months of my sobriety, yeah, we're at 18 months now, because remember I spent 6 months on my 4-step, I hung out with the guys, because the guys gave me the attention that I wanted, and the guys would not hold me accountable to the behaviors, right? Like, my sponsor would tell me that when you're in trouble, a guy's going to slap your ass while a woman picks it up. And I was like, ooh, sorry, language. I've been doing so good. I'm working on it. That's one of the things I work on. You know, how to be a professional. But then, you know, the studies say that people that cuss have really high IQ, so I, of course, got to brag about that. So I learn how to be a friend, and I learn how to be in a relationship, and my sponsor tells me that I'm not allowed to hang out with the boys anymore, that I now have to get a phone number of a woman at every meeting I go to and call her, that I'm no longer allowed to go to the 10:30 Westlake meeting, which on the streets is called the Dirty 30, because it got all the attention that I'd ever sought. You know, I was the cute, young, fun, spunky girl that everybody wanted to be friends with. And it's like all I wanted was people to love me, and I got all that. And it was not the right kind of attention. You know, talking about the guy that was abstinent, I decided to try it. And I was like, I'll go 30 days. And once I hit 30 days, I was like, oh, I did it. I was like, I'm going to go 60. Then I went 90. And at the end of those 90 days, I could see myself. I looked myself in the eyes for the first time, and I wasn't disgusted by what I saw. And I knew that if I were to have a one-night stand early in sobriety, that was it. I was going back out because of the shame and the guilt. And so I committed to a year. I said, you know, I'm not going to sleep with anyone for a year. I didn't say anything about dating. So I dated a guy that just happened to be stationed in Okinawa, Japan. So it made it really hard to mess up on my promise. But I still got the attention that I needed, right? And so by 18 months, him and I had broken up. And I'm sitting there just like seeking all this stuff. And she was like, the women are what you're seeking. You're seeking closeness. You're seeking relationship. You're seeking vulnerability and intimacy that you've never had in your life. And so I had to pick 5 women that I wanted to build relationship with. And I had to call those 5 women every week, and I had to make plans with them every week. I was only allowed to go to particular meetings, and I had to check myself and check my motives every time I went to those meetings, if it was a mixed meeting. And out of that project, you know, or suggestion, like, I learned how to be a woman. I was no longer this little girl walking around in sweatpants and a wife beater, scrappy from the streets, like thinking that I had something to prove. Like, I was able to have dignity and grace and not chew people out when they didn't do what I wanted them to do. I was able to have conversations with women because other women don't put up with that kind of talk. Like, you could talk smack to a guy and he's just going to laugh and say whatever and move on. But if you really want to be in real relationship with another human being, like, you have to talk to them like a human being. And I didn't know how to do that. I talked to people like they were my minions. And if you don't do what I need you to do, then you can get out of my way and I'll find somebody else to do it for me. And so now I've created this community. Like, I was the kind of person growing up that had 1,000 friends, but not one. Like, I knew everyone at school, and everyone knew me. Like, of course, how do you not know who Ryan is? But I did not belong to one group. And for the first time in my life, I belonged to a group. I've got service commitments that people expect me to show up to. And they admire me for the work that I put in. And they thank me for showing up and being honest and vulnerable and intimate. And then the second worst thing ever happens in my life. And my best friend Adam, who was a brother to me, a big brother to my brother, had a work accident and dies. And I get that phone call while I'm at work, and I lose it. And the first woman that I call is a woman in the rooms. One of those women on that list. And she tells her boss, I gotta go. And she shows up and she picks me up from work, and I spend the next year screaming at God, blaming God for all of the heartache that I've ever had. I hated God. I hated the stupid program. I hated sobriety. Why would I be sober if I got to deal with this kind of stuff? You told me that life was going to get better. And the only thing I knew to do was just keep sharing. And I showed up to every meeting angry. And I've been in therapy all this time. Like, I'm trying to get rid of my anger, and here it comes. And it came with a vengeance. And my roommate, my poor roommate, I mean, I would sit up at night screaming bloody murder, punching pillows, screaming F you God over and over and over again. I was so angry. Not to mention, like, I think looking back at that, like, I never really truly grieved my brother's death. And so when I lost this other guy that was like a brother to me, like, it all just kind of came back up. And so I got to grieve it all together. And the only thing I can think of, the reason why I stayed sober through all that, is because of the fellowship. Because of those relationships that I was able to build. When I didn't answer my phone and they called me however many times, they showed up at my house and banged on my door until I opened it. Ooh, did that make me mad? Because don't you know, I am trying to isolate and stay away from all you people. I don't want anything to do with a solution. Would you just let me sulk in my, ooh, poor me, poor me? And I wanted nothing more than to smoke. But every time I smoked, one of my friends would call me the moment that I thought about calling that guy and saying, bring some over. You know, and like, every time I felt lonely, I'd go to a meeting. And y'all knew what was going on because I shared. And I made it through that year. And it was probably the worst year of my life. Because I didn't have the drugs and the alcohol to numb the pain anymore. I had to feel all of it. But there's a saying in the rooms that they say more will be revealed, right? And that I firmly believe that my higher power only gives me what I can handle with help. But I have to ask for that help. And that year taught me how to ask for help. Because I couldn't get through it alone. And I knew that drugs and alcohol weren't going to fix it because I'd already tried that before. And so I started being dishonest. I started seeking that attention again. I started going behind my sponsor's back. And she dropped me and she said, I love you and I'm not abandoning you. But you need to find someone you can be honest with or you're going to relapse. And at that point in time, I had to make a choice. Between the guy that had continually cheated on me, who was also in the rooms, between going down that same path that I had been going down, or getting a new sponsor and getting busy again. And I got a new sponsor, and oh my God, was she evil. She was terrible. She would tell me, well, if you know everything, then why did you ask me to be your sponsor? She would say, obviously what you've been doing isn't working, or else you wouldn't have asked me and you wouldn't come crawling to me on your hands and knees begging for help because you thought you were going to relapse. Ryan, shut up and listen to me. These are the kind of things she would talk to me. And I was just like, why are you so mean? And what happened was that ego that I had built up over 3.5 years, because I've stayed sober for 3.5 years. Don't you know that I know how to do this thing? Never mind that I'm crying myself to sleep all over again, just like I was 3.5 years before. And I worked through the steps with her again. And I got serious. I did a step work in a way that I had never done it before. And I didn't just get to check boxes on, you know, this affected my self-esteem, my pride. Like, I had to write down how it affected me. I had to look at things I had never been willing to look at before. And in my sex inventory, she looks at me and she says, so you're straight, right? And I was like, meh, well, I mean, sure. What? She says, what does that mean? I said, well, I consider myself straight. You know, when I see my picture, I'm going to fall in love with, you know, a man and have a family and the white picket fence and all that. But I haven't ever ruled out that I may fall in love with a woman one day. And she says, you know how when they tell alcoholics that if they're contemplating whether they're alcoholics or not, they probably are? She's like, if you're contemplating your sexuality, you might want to explore that a little bit more. So I see that as a pass to get on Tinder. And I'm just swiping away, you know, interested in anybody. Thank God nothing came to fruition there. But I look at that experience and it's just like, we have this wonderful way of taking direction and making it what we want it to be, right? And so while I was going through the steps with that sponsor, she told me that I was not allowed to flirt, date, or the other F. Because whenever I needed something, I needed to go to God. Well, if you remember, like, I was angry at God, right? And so she taught me how to recreate God for real this time. And in a meditation, I created light. And that's my God, light. And so when there's darkness, all I have to do is reach for the light. And in that process, I met my wife. Yeah, surprise. And the funny thing is, I was the only one that was surprised by that. Everybody else was like, oh yeah, I figured. What? Nobody was going to clue me in on this? But again, more will be revealed, right? Like, I was not ready for the amount of vulnerability and intimacy it takes to be in a committed, healthy relationship. And those of you that think you're in love, may the force be with you. Because I had avoided all of that sexual abuse for now 4.5 years into sobriety. 4 years. I don't know how many years I'd been sober. But I had avoided it. I hadn't had to work on it really in my steps. I hadn't really had to work on it in therapy. I was coasting. I was happy. I was content. Things were going on. Well, you can't really be in a committed, healthy relationship without working on that. And this person has seen sides of me that I didn't even know existed. And what does she do when she sees those sides of me? She says, "What can I do for you?" And she holds me. And whenever I want to push away, she stands there. And that is something I had never experienced before. Like, I learned how to love so deeply because y'all loved me. When I would cut myself open and throw my guts on the table and say, "Look, can you see me now?" You would say, "Yeah, I do. And I still love you." And that was because I shared. Because I was honest. Because not once did I hold back that dirty, nasty, ugly truth. You know, I just did a fifth step with a sponsee. And we read in the big book where it talks about, you know, the stage character that we show everybody else. And we know in our hearts that we don't deserve whatever it is we're showing people. I'm not a big book thumper. I don't know it verbatim. But I told her, I said, "You know, when you don't want everybody else to think you're a bully, but you're a bully." I was like, "Until you can see that, you can't let it go." And she's just like bawling. She's like, "I don't want to be a bully." I'm like, "Good. Now we got something to work with." You know, until we're able to see those things, like, we can't move to the other side. And I wish I could stand up and tell you that my sobriety has been beautiful and that everything has worked out how I ever wanted it to. And that I haven't had any problems or any obstacles to get through. And I can't. And I used to call people liars because they told me that it was going to get better. You told me it was going to get better. That's why I got sober. The difference is that everything else on the outside is still the same. Like, the heartache is still the same. The death is still the same. The job loss, the job gain, the car breaking down, the money coming, the money going, that's all still the same. But the difference is that I get to stand in that hurt and pain and fear with dignity, with grace, with honor, things that I didn't even know existed before I got to the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just got laid off 1.5 months ago. And the funny thing is that I asked God to do it. I woke up that morning and I said, "I don't know what to do here. Like, help me." Because I had an opportunity for another job that I ended up not even getting. But I was so conflicted because I've been so unhappy in this position for so long. But I needed money. I needed a job. I got to pay the bills, right? And then 1.5 hours after I ask God for direction, I get laid off. And then the first thing I think of when I get off the phone is like, "All right, God, you got this. Where are we going now?" Like, don't get me wrong, I cried a little bit. I was sad. I grew so much with that organization. But I know that there is something greater on the other side because this program has taught me that. This program has taught me that in the darkness and the dirtiest and the nastiest, I've watched people with 7 DWIs walk away scot-free. That doesn't happen in reality. But in a world with a higher power's purpose, anything is possible. anything. Like me getting married, that's possible. Like I was sitting there on my wedding day going, Dad, did you really think this would happen? And he's like, yeah. What? I'm like, I didn't think it would happen. You know, like my wife just graduated from the fire academy on Friday and went to her first day at a station yesterday. And that was hell. But I didn't have to drink to pass the time. You know, I got to be of service. I got to read a book. I got to play with my new puppy. Like, I get to show up for life when I am terrified of it. But today, I'm responsible. We have a will. We have life insurance that we pay for every month. We have a savings account. So if anything does happen that's completely out of my control, like, the things that are in my control, I get to take care of today because I'm a responsible contributing member of society. And when I showed up here, I was making thousands of dollars a month and not a dime in savings. You know, so I can't guarantee you by any means that life is going to be amazing and beautiful, but I can guarantee you that you get to show up for it. I did not want to come here tonight. I didn't want to go to the graduate or the retirement party that I came from. It took me an hour and a half to get to Austin. I live in San Antonio. I wanted to stay in my house and veg out and watch TV and ignore reality because I'm still an alcoholic every day. But I know that I don't get to keep that reality if I don't show up and I don't come and share with y'all, you know, what it could be like. I'm no different than any one of you. I may not have a treatment center in my story, but I have the same pain and heartache and despair that gets us here, right? And that you have the same amount of courage, strength, tenacity, and determination to get to that next day and stay sober. I promise you. Just be honest, open, and willing. Thank you for letting me be of service.